Well, Danny Cashman, host of The Night Show, we're getting down to it here. Almost time to say goodbye to a show that has been a part of your life in many ways since you were, what, in college, high school, in the basement of your parents' house?
Yeah, I guess the earliest days of the show could be considered in my bedroom. I used to pretend I was David Letterman in my bedroom, and I'd write up my own little stupid top 10 lists, and I would sit at my desk and try to mimic his mannerisms. And nobody saw that, including my parents, thank God, because they probably would have sent me away somewhere. But that was the beginning of it. I think I was probably 9 or 10 years old at that point when I started trying to emulate what I was seeing on television.
So what was it that made you as a young man look to those shows, the talk shows in particular? That's not a that's not something that your average youngster gravitates to.
I remember the night that I first saw Letterman. I don't remember when I first saw Johnny Carson, but I feel like I had probably seen him before. But there was something about Letterman that drew me to the TV set. I was in my parents' basement. My brother was having a sleepover with some friends, and the way our basement was situated, there was a small TV and a little rolly cart, and we had space in front of that to set up sleeping bags when we had a sleepover. So I was walking by, and we just had the TV on like you did back then, and I saw this guy in a suit doing something weird. I don't remember what it was, but it just captivated me. And I stopped in my tracks and I sat on the sleeping bag and I watched the whole episode. I do remember Siskel and Ebert were on. And I remember sitting there thinking to myself, I want to do that at some point in life. Now, I didn't realize at the time how difficult it would be to do that at David Letterman's level, but it definitely grabbed a hold of me. And the more I watched him, the more I realized that he had the ability on that show to do anything. Whether it was magic with the discount magician, or if it was have a unknown musical guest on that he happened to like, or talk with a baseball legend. It's like the guy was just hitting all the buttons that I was interested in as a kid, and doing it in this 1 hour format that was both structured but also freewheeling. And it was funny, and it was just funny. He was dropping stuff off buildings, and it really appealed to, I think, kids. Maybe it wasn't supposed to, but I think it did, and it captured me for life. And then from there, I started watching Carson a little bit, and then when Letterman went to CBS, I started watching him every night, and I'd watch Conan, and I've never lost my love for the format of late-night television.
So the original version of the show, when did that start, and where did you tape those early episodes?
Sure. The original version started on David Letterman's birthday, on April 12th, 1997. And we taped the very first versions of those shows at the Old Town Community Center, which has been torn down since. We had to find some new locations for a variety of reasons. We ended up doing most of the run of that show, that original version, at the Old Town Knights of Columbus Hall.
And who was your first guest?
The first guest was Skip Chappelle, now the namesake for the Skip Chappelle Court. Wow. At the Pit, at the Memorial Gym at the University of Maine. He, longtime coach of the University of Maine men's basketball team and graduate of Old Town High School and the University of Maine, drafted for the NBA, I believe, by the St. Louis Hawks, didn't end up playing, came home to Maine. And he had such a great story to tell, and he told it on our first show. And I feel very fortunate that he was willing to come on a show that nobody gave a shot to succeeding. But the shelf life of that first guest has sustained. He's still out there doing stuff and having basketball courts named after him and active with the University of Maine. And I'm proud to say he was our first guest 28 years ago.
Well, and of course, maybe people don't know, there was a family connection there with Skip Chappelle and your grandfather.
Yeah, that's probably part of the reason he said yes. He probably felt guilted into it. My grandfather coached a semi-pro team, owned a semi-pro team, and coached it in Old Town back in the 50s by the name of Jack's Five. And Skip was one of the members of that team, as well as Leroy Patterson and Dick Sturgeon and Don Sturgeon. And they had a great legacy. And Skip became fast friends with both my grandparents and my parents. And still to this day, if you go to a University of Maine basketball game, they're out of season now, but if you go next season, you'll probably see my parents and Skip sitting together.
That's fantastic. Now, was it on that cable access show when you managed to get as a guest the legendary singer-songwriter Don McLean?
Yeah, that was one of those little eye-popping moments where I said, I can't believe we're doing this. And that was probably the first eye-popping moment, in fact. He was performing at the Collins Center for the Arts, had a performance coming up. So I reached out to see if he'd be willing to come on the show. And the person who I reached out to, I think, was in New York City. And they said, well, it would be great if he could come on the show before that concert so he could promote it. And I said, would he be willing to do that? And they said, yeah. So by some weird twist of fate, we had Don McLean sitting in a metal folding chair in the Old Town Community Center in front of a white bed sheet that we used as a backdrop, doing pieces of Starry, Starry Night. And he did This Land Is Your Land, which was a way he liked to close out shows at the time. And he talked all about his career. And I was very sweaty during that interview. It was not, well, not my finest work.
He can sometimes, now we've had him on the show a few times. He's been great with us, but apparently he can be a little prickly at times. How was he with you guys?
He was great after the fact. So I don't think anybody told him there would be an audience.
Oh.
So he wasn't super happy to see that there was a line of people outside when he pulled in. And also, it wasn't a public access station, but it looked like a public access production. I don't think he was super happy about that. I think he was thinking it was going to be a little bit more than what he ran into. But when he was done, and even during the interview, he was pleasant. When he was done, he had some really kind things to say. And then a friend of mine went to see his show in Orono, and that friend had him sign a picture to me, or a ticket to me. And he said some really kind things to my friend as well about the way that whole show, that whole experience ran for him. And he was really happy he did it. So there was definite kindness there, but I think he was taken by surprise at what he saw when he pulled in.
We're talking with Danny Cashman. So you took a break. You were a college student. You've settled into the work world. And then about 15, maybe 16 years ago, you started getting the itch again to go back on television. And how did you end up being on what feels like every network affiliate in the state of Maine?
Well, it started with WABI in Bangor. That's the CBS affiliate, Maine's first television station. And once we formed a bit of a partnership with the New England School of Communications at Husson University to try and produce this thing, next thing we needed was a place to run it. And WABI agreed pretty quickly. The program director there, Steve Hiltz, has always been supportive of the show, even when we were on other stations. We had a conversation at some point where he was telling me that he didn't understand why they couldn't do what we were doing. So when we came to him and said, we would like to do what we were doing, but at a higher level and on your station at 11:30, I don't know what sort of magic he pulled behind the scenes, but he came back to me with a pretty quick yes. And from there, they established a connection with us at one of the stations in Portland. We've bounced around different stations in Portland since then. But for the last 11 years, we've been on the Fox affiliate and the CBS affiliate in Portland. And then we found our way to Aroostook County, and we're on the NBC affiliate in Aroostook County now as well. So I think it's just a matter of knowing what we wanted to do and where we wanted to do it and finding a path to get there, but also working really hard to make sure that the stations were proud to put what we were doing on their stations.
Now, I'm going to tell you a story I don't think I've ever told you before. Less than a year before you approached Channel 5, I actually went to them and talked with the general manager at the time, Mike Young, about doing a late night show. Did you know that?
I had no idea. No, this is the first I'm hearing about this.
So, and I pitched a show, and I didn't quite know what it was, but, sort of following some kind of late night talk show format. And they were concerned, first of all, about, because I mentioned bringing on some music guests, they were concerned with having to pay rights for somebody else's compositions that they aired. And then, obviously, a big obstacle was, at the time, at least before you came along, that was not a time of night that had a big viewing audience, and they were concerned that they couldn't make any money on it that time of night. They were basically giving away commercial space that time because they didn't have any original programming to speak of, and they would have had to bring in a crew. And I think one of the genius things that you did that made your show possible, other than being better at it than me, is that you also established that connection with the New England School of Communications, which made it possible, I think, to actually have a show airing on local television without the TV station having to pay a bunch of people.
Yeah. And that partnership was vital. When I first had the first conversation about bringing this back, I said, we need to do it right. And doing it right meant having people that knew what they were doing behind the cameras and behind the audio board and making sure all of that stuff flowed correctly. Because I don't know how to do that stuff. And I don't know many people that do. So when I met with the New England School of Communications, it was made very clear up front by all parties that this has to be a student first production, meaning it has to be a learning environment, learning experience for them. They need to be able to take something away from the experience. The people that are involved now, I feel like our family, Rodney Verrill and Eric Ferguson and all sorts of people behind the scenes, but they didn't know me from Adam back then. And so they put a lot of trust in my word by me saying this will definitely be an educational experience. And if it stops working for them or stops working for the stations or stops working for me, we just end it. So we had a commitment of 4 tapings. We do 3 shows at a time in a taping. So we had 12 episodes. And everyone agreed at the end of the 12 episodes, let's keep going. And we haven't stopped. So it went from a 12-episode commitment to now, I believe, in this most recent version, we are upwards of almost 600 shows. And that wouldn't have happened if not for the work of the New England School of Communications.
Well, your legacy in television here in the state of Maine, I think, is, I mean, it's up there with the greats in the history of Maine television. But I, from my perspective, one of the things that you have done that I think puts you on that Maine broadcasting Mount Rushmore is the exposure you've given to Maine musical artists, which I think has been just something incredible for musicians in general and for viewers, too, here in Maine.
Yeah, and it's, I was involved in playing music for some time, and there's a lot of people that offer you exposure in exchange for performing. And we have been extraordinarily fortunate that the level of exposure that we've been able to give musicians has been beneficial to them, because there aren't many TV platforms in Maine for musicians to strut their stuff. 207 does a fine job, but I would imagine that their studio is, I would think, somewhat limited. We have a giant sweeping stage with a full audio team mixing the music so it comes out right. And that's a rarity, not only in local TV, but it's becoming a rarity in national TV. You look at Late Night with Seth Meyers. They no longer not only have a house band, they don't have musical guests anymore. So even on a national stage, some of these things are becoming a little bit more rare. And I feel very fortunate that we've been able to highlight music. And that was one of the driving factors for me wanting to bring this back on television, was to be able to highlight some of the super talented musicians in our state, not just the ones that you've heard of because they've achieved some notoriety and level of success, but also some that maybe you've never heard of. And maybe that will drive you to check them out on Spotify or at Bull Moose or wherever, to be able to hear more from them. And I like to think that we hopefully played some sort of a part in elevating the music scene in Maine.
You've done some wonderful and memorable sketches through the years, but I want to ask you, how many total injuries have you sustained doing sketches for the show?
Several injuries to my pride.
Oh, well.
I think the only lasting injury, I guess there were two. I did skydiving. I wouldn't call this an injury, but we went skydiving about a year and a half ago. And later in life, I have developed a little bit of a motion sickness. And I guess I didn't recognize that propelling down towards the earth from 10,000 feet up would create some sort of motion sickness. So I think some of the footage that wasn't on TV, you can see me turn a delightful shade of green. And then and then my color comes back. So I don't know if I'd call that an injury, but I did break my toe in one sketch that we did where we were running around Bangor recreating scenes from the movie Elf. And there was a scene where I was supposed to run into the lockers in a locker room, emulating what Will Ferrell did in the movie. And the person shooting the sketch yelled cut just as I was about to hit the lockers. So I tried to stop, but my feet, they were wet. So they slid right into the locker and my pinky toe caught the edge of one of the stands of the lockers. I didn't know it was broken until I got home and took off my shoes. And that was not a pleasant sight, but I think that's the only actual injury I've sustained.
Well, and you nearly got swept down the Penobscot River, right?
Yes, but there was a team of law enforcement professionals standing by just in case.
Okay. Well, it's always good to have them around your show, I would think. You've had so many remarkable guests, both from here in the state of Maine, nationally known folks. I don't want to ask for one, but who are some of the guests that you're very proud to have had on your show over the years?
Mark Summers is among the top. He and I have become friends. For those who don't know Mark, he is I grew up knowing him as the host of Double Dare on Nickelodeon. He has also been the host of Unwrapped on the Food Network. He has a lengthy resume of other things he's hosted and or produced. Most recently, he was in a Hallmark movie, his first, called Hanukkah on the Rocks. It was, I think, Hallmark's only Hanukkah movie this season. And he's just become a good friend. I mean, we went to see Darlene Love together in Massachusetts. He's just become a good friend. And I never would have thought that would have happened when I grew up idolizing him on Double Dare. Rob Bartlett has become a good friend of the show. He has decades of a career working with Don Imus and also as a stand-up comic and an actor and other things, including stuff on Broadway and on network television. Ed Asner was a big treat. He has the most Emmys of any male in television history. And for some reason, I found myself sitting beside him on my show. I never would have thought that possible. Patrick Dempsey was a lot of fun. Weird Al Yankovic in sketch form was a lot of fun. All of the local guests that we've had on have brought something to the table in one way, shape, or form. And there's a couple of surprises coming up for the end. And I'm not going to lie. I'm giddy as a school child about those. I don't understand how we got this fortunate to be able to close this up in the way we're closing it up, but I'm excited about the end, but I'm excited about the end of how we're wrapping this thing up.
You've used so many of the elements of late night shows, but I've always been fascinated by the fact that you have continued to do a monologue on the show with a huge obstacle, and that's the fact that you tape in advance. What's the worst you've ever been burned by, although you have the ability to go in and edit, but have you had any situations where you got to that point where you're putting the show together and said, wow, I can't use much of this?
There's been a couple of times, not a lot, and I don't even remember the specific situations, but for that reason, that third show that we tape in sequence is usually based on events that are coming up, like a home show or a concert being somewhere or something. And it's usually in advance. So like we would say Aerosmith is performing this Thursday, not Aerosmith performed this past Thursday, because if it got rained out, then it doesn't make any sense. So we've tried very hard to structure that in a way that is timely and also very minimal risk of it being canceled. When COVID shut everything down, we had to run a disclaimer before 2 weeks worth of monologues because there was no way to edit around it. Most of the monologue was supposed to be topical about stuff that was happening in the coming days, and all of it had been canceled. So there was a disclaimer at the beginning of the monologue. I would say that's probably the most significant way that we were burned. I don't know if I'd call it burned, but we definitely had to make some accommodations to make the show still appear relevant.
What's the most surprising moment that's happened to you on The Night Show, Dan?
I think the most surprising, I'll say two. Michael Winslow came on the show. He was the guy who did all the funny voices on Police Academy. And somebody called us that day of our taping and said, Michael Winslow would like to come to your show. That doesn't happen in Bangor, Maine, where people just call and say, yeah, I'm in town. Can I come to your show? So he showed up and we worked out a little sketch with him and he did it. And then as we're going to break, he started mimicking the sound of Brian Netto's trumpet into his mic. And we had this lovely musical improv moment where the band was trading off with him as sort of a vocal artist. And the students and staff for the New England School of Communications had the foresight to continue rolling and make sure that they captured all of this, because normally we don't. And it was wonderful. It was a huge surprise that they just started playing off each other. I had nothing to do with it. I was just sitting in the front row, you know, watching this all happen, saying, how lucky am I? I'd say that was one. And the other one was when Ed Asner was on the show. I didn't know what sort of a personality he would come out with. I know he has this cantankerous attitude, but he's also very sweet. He's also very serious at times about causes that are important to him. And he is very passionate about the work that he has done. And he was promoting a one-man show that he was doing in Maine. So I didn't know where he was going to go. He came out with that cantankerous attitude. And I don't know why I didn't expect it, but I didn't. I think maybe he threw me off a little bit when he was so kind to everybody backstage. But I gave it right back to him. And I was nervous sort of in my internal monologue about being disrespectful to him.
Yeah, but he loved it.
But he loved it. He had the sweetest, kindest things to say when we were done. He pulled me in close, said a few things, and gave me a hug and went on his way. And I stood there on stage thinking to myself, what just happened? How did that all just happen? And I didn't have time to think about it or worry about it. And I think maybe that's why, I think that's the part that was surprising to me, was that I always, when I would see Don Rickles on with Letterman, I would wonder, what would I do if I were in that situation? And then I found myself in that situation with Ed Asner. And I like to think that I did what I would hope I would have done being in that situation. And I played with him at a level he was happy with.
Well, Danny, you have made so many memories for so many people over all these years. Congratulations on an incredible run, and we all look forward to seeing what you do next, even if it means we just have to come to your house and watch.
You might have to. I have seating for like four or five. Usually I have some snack bags and some juice boxes. So, you're welcome. Just reserve your tickets.
Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Rich.